This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Welcome back and happy holidays, everybody. Another episode, Green and Bold Podcast. With you once again, as always, I'm Joe Stiglich alongside David Feldman. Feldy, happy holidays to you. How are things treating you these days?
It's good, Joe. And how did you spend December 25th? We know it's a very special day. It's, of course, the birth of Ricky Henderson that we work on a stops and celebrates. And it's a beautiful day.
Yes, it is. It was good. Always a lot of food, I'm kind of a big sweets guy. I'm usually not a big cookie guy, but during Christmas time, it's cookie overload for me. My whole family makes cookies of one kind or another. And can't resist them. Really can't resist the cookies when it comes to this time of year, let me tell you.
Yeah. You know, Tim Roy, the Warriors radio play-by-play announcer, every Christmas, his wife makes these chocolate peanut butter balls. And it's like the greatest. You just wait for that first game right before Christmas, or the last game right before Christmas, because then Tim brings out the whole barrel of them. And it's so special to get that. The Tim Roy chocolate peanut butter ball. It's unbelievable.
That's pretty good stuff. I have gotten to the gym a couple times the past couple of days. So I'm trying to fight back against it, the holiday dietary, all the goodness that goes on, trying to work it off just a little bit. Hey man, we're back here doing another episode. And I think we got some good stuff to talk about because one, the A's have themselves a manager now. Just a few days ago, they officially announced Mark Kotze as their new skipper to replace Bob Melvin, who we all know has left to manage the San Diego Padres. So Mark Kotze gets a 3-year contract. He's got a club option for 2025. And, you know, it seems like coaching changes in most sports, including baseball, kind of a big deal for most teams, but not a huge deal because it's part of the business. And I feel like so many teams cycle through a coach sometimes every 2 or 3 years, you know, and you have that kind of turnover. Different story, though, when it comes to the A's. I mean, Melvin was entrenched in the dugout for a full decade. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like I have a lot of curiosity going into this season. I mean, I have no idea what this A's roster is going to look like. And I don't think we'll know for a while now what the roster is going to look like. But, you know, just a different voice in the dugout to me. It truly feels like it's a new chapter, and the A's are turning the page. And to say nothing against Bob at all, I mean, he was terrific success. Loved working with him on a day-to-day basis when I was on the beat. But first time in a while that we've been able to talk about a manager change. And I'm really curious to see how it goes with Kotze, and because it definitely feels like just a new kind of a new era for the A's.
It does. And for me, this is the first time where the A's have had a manager's change where it really didn't matter who they hired, to me, to be honest with you. And it sounds strange. The job of the baseball manager has changed so much, you know, especially in the last 25 years. It's not like you go back even into the Tony La Russa A's and into the mid-90s, the manager was in charge of the ball club, right? There was a general manager. General managers a lot of times were former players and they would give their opinion, but the manager was really in charge of the roster and in-game decisions. And as we know, the game has totally changed from that now. The manager is definitely more of a figurehead. They still manage the game and the bullpen, but there's kind of a script also laid out for them. And they're kind of told what the front office would like them to do in these situations. So it's very different. And so I think when you look at what the A's needed a manager, and we thought when Bob first left, we had our podcast and we said Kotze was a logical choice, right? It was going to be Kotze or Christensen. They were the two front runners. And probably whoever didn't get the job would leave. Well, as soon as Christensen went and he joined Bob Melvin in San Diego, it was pretty obvious it was going to be Mark Kotze. Now, they did talk to other candidates. And the one name that I really liked was Will Venable, the former player, Bay Area guy, smart kid. I was very intrigued by him. I liked him as a player and I liked him in a front office role as well. But Kotze was still the logical choice. And he's going to take on a team that, as you said, we really don't know what the roster is going to be, right? We're in a lockout now. You didn't get keys to the lockout for Christmas, did you?
I did not. Did not have that in my stocking. No keys in my stocking. Yeah.
No keys. So we're stuck in a lockout. So you don't know what the roster is going to be, but odds are that it's going to be quite different than what we've seen. Kotze, though, knows the deal. He's been part of this organization for long enough. He knows the people involved. He knows the front office involved. He is, I think he's going to be very good with the media. And that's kind of one of the big chores now for a manager. And the second big chore is keeping a clubhouse together and focused on day-to-day and winning. And I think he's going to be very good in that regard as well.
Yeah, I like the pick. I mean, I like the pick. Yeah, I'm with you. We talked about it the last episode we did. We thought Kotze was probably the clubhouse leader going in, right? And he ends up being the guy. But I think it's a nice blending of both worlds because, you know, there is continuity. He coached under Melvin for a long time. I think he probably absorbed a lot from Bob going in. This is Kotze's first managerial job on any level, you know, so got to learn from a real veteran manager there and probably absorbed quite a bit. But also feel like he's going to be his own man and his own person. I think he'll stick up for what he wants to do. And I know, as you alluded to, front offices right now, front offices are more hands-on than they've ever been as far as the input they have, the data, the sabermetrics, and who's going to be in the lineup every day and that kind of thing. But I think Kotze will – it's important to be your own person and really establish that authority in the clubhouse and let players know that you are your own man. I think – That was one strength of Bob Melvin's. And I think I think Mark Kotze is going to be the same kind of person. So I think he will have the respect of the clubhouse. We'll see how he does when the games start to count for real and the strategy kicks in and what moves he makes, you know, when a game comes down to the line in the late innings. But I think it's a good choice because I think personality wise, he fits well. And I think he's ready. I think he's ready for this kind of job that he's stepping into.
Yeah, he's definitely ready. I think what's always funny is I saw this on Twitter. Like, oh, Mark Kotze, is he going to run more? What's he going to do? He's going to run more. Fans always want teams to run more. We always see this. And what's funny, especially with the A's, you know, the team that we follow as closely as we do, when they have players who can run, they run. Starling Marte was a great example of that, right? He could run. He ran. He was fantastic. It was exciting. And he didn't get caught, so he didn't make outs, right? When the season started, Ramon Laureano was running. And it was great. And then he got caught a couple times and then he stopped running. Because that's the A's philosophy. You can run, you show you can be safe all the time, you can keep running. As soon as you get thrown out a couple times, you're not running anymore. Outs are too valuable. So it's funny when they say, he's going to run more, he's going to run. And fans always want you to run more. You got to have the players to do that with. And again, not up to him. And that's the thing. It's so different. I keep thinking about the Dodgers. Game 5 of the NLDS against the Giants. And Dave Roberts has to go out and face the media and explain why Corey Knebel is starting and not Urias. It wasn't Dave Roberts' decision. He should not have been the one answering these questions, right? Andrew Friedman, the Dodger front office should be answering. They made this decision. But that's the manager's job now, is to be the front person for the front office and to be, unfortunately, a lot of times the fall guy for the front office. That's what's going to be interesting with Kotze, because Kotze is his own man. And if you think back to the end of the 2006 season, Ken Maka finishing up the year. Remember, Maka managed for 3 years. His contract was not renewed. They were going to have a new manager in 06. Nothing really came of it. They interviewed Oral Hershiser and some other people. And Ken Maka came back for another 3-year contract. And this team wins the West. They win the division series. They go to the ALs. No team has gone this far. And then Ken Maka is then fired at the end of the 2006 season because he had lost the clubhouse. And a lot of that had to do with Mark Kotze and Jason Kendall. And I know you had started covering the team then, so you had a firsthand look at what was going on. So Kotze knows how important it is to keep the clubhouse because he was on the other side of that once. And he basically led a revolt against a manager.
I actually took over on the beat the year after that. Bob Guerin's first year, 07, was my first year on the beat, but you're right. Disconnect. A disconnect was the word used when Maka was let go. I thought it was interesting in his introductory press conference, Kotze mentioned, and it stood out to me. He mentioned, I'm more emotional than Bob. I'm more emotional for good and bad. He said, you know, he just wears his emotions more on his sleeve. And I'm curious to see how that manifests itself, whether it's just barking at umpires more or visibly showing a lot more emotion than dugouts, or if it's just going to be, he's going to light the team up if he thinks they need it in the clubhouse after a game, sometimes that kind of thing, you know, I mean, kind of a cliche saying, is the manager going to flip the spread? I don't know how much spread flipping goes on or how much it ever did. If that's more of a figure of speech than anything, but will more of that go on when the going gets tough and the team's not playing that well, I don't know, but it's interesting when he mentions he's an emotional guy. And he is an emotional, fiery guy. I just want to see how that plays out. It's very noticeable from the outside looking in, and maybe what kind of effect that has in the clubhouse, just the overall vibe of the team too.
Yeah, and he talked about maybe expanding the coaching staff.
That's not a surprise too. Another trend we're kind of seeing in the major leagues, and we saw it just across the bay too. It's worked out pretty well for the Giants, seems like.
Yeah, and they're bringing in, you know, the Giants brought in people who didn't have a lot of major league experience, that were a little younger, but they were into the game and into how to make players better using a combination of analytics and teaching. And it worked for them. And I can see the A's trying to go a little bit that way with some people who you might not have heard of who could still have an influence on the bench. I think the coaching staff is going to look a little different, and it's fine. I'm not very excited about 14 coaches. I think that's a little overkill. You know, you see with the Giants, the NBA now is ridiculous. It's like one coach per player now in the NBA. There's many, now all the coaches in the NBA wear sweatsuits when they coach, but there's 12 guys in sweatsuits, and then there's like the seven players on the bench.
NBA coaching staff, they're going like three rows deep.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And you look back when the Warriors won their first title as the Golden State Warriors in 75, they had two coaches. They had Al Addles and Joe Roberts. Mm-hmm. And they did just fine. And just the other day, the Warriors won in Phoenix and four of their coaches were out, and they did just fine. Sometimes it's a little overkill. But as soon as one team has success doing it one way, there's definitely going to be some copying of that. We've always seen it. The NBA coaching staffs exploded. Now the MLB coaching staffs are exploding. Is it a bad thing? No, it's not a bad thing. More work for Mickey Morabito to have to travel more people, but right. You know what? If you have people who can are designated a certain job and can help you in that field, in that discipline, great, let's do it. And I think Kotze is open to that.
You know, I did a podcast with Mark Kotze when he first joined the A's back spring of 2016. It was actually the first podcast episode I ever recorded or hosted when I was with what was then Comcast Sportsnet Bay Area. Had Kotze on, and he said a couple things that stuck with me and were interesting. I asked him about his inside the park home run, of course, in the division series against the Twins in 2006. I said, how often do you think back on that moment, or do you get asked about it? And he talked about the 2006 team, and he mentioned, he goes, you know what, that team, he was talking about the players in the clubhouse. He said, that team had a special chemistry. He goes, and we were really tight and we really had fun. He said, and I found myself in my other stops, other teams I went to as a player, I found myself trying to recreate that vibe we had from that 06 team. Because it was so good and so special, and he enjoyed it so much. And he also said, you know what, I was lucky enough to get the three league championship series as a player, and they all ended the same. I was on the losing end of every LCS that I played in. And he says, it's something, kind of a message he's always tried to impart to players. Just saying, you know, the window is small. Your window to achieve what you want to achieve is going to be really small. So don't take anything for granted, and do what you have to do to try to make those special moments happen. And he goes, and it starts in spring training. So, I mean, nothing mind-blowing right there, but maybe just a little look into maybe the messaging that he'll try to get across to this team, and kind of what makes him tick, both as a player, maybe now as a manager too. So, but he mentioned 06, being on the A's that year, one of four seasons he played with the A's. He was pretty good with the A's. He had some good years at the A's. That 06 team really left an impact on him.
Yeah, I think the 06 team, you talk about chemistry, and I think it started with Nick Swisher and Milton Bradley. I mean, the fun that they had. Frank Thomas was just an easygoing guy, right? He could fit in with anybody, and Frank was great. But Milton Bradley had this, you know, terrible reputation. And then you have Swish, who's loud and boisterous, and they got along famously. And it was always seems like one guy hit a home run, the other guy hit a home run. And I thought that went a long way to the chemistry with that team, that relationship. Maybe it just brought Milton into the fold. And so he wasn't an outsider and he was part of this club. That was a special team. And they also knew they didn't have Hudson and Mulder anymore, right? It's Kirk Sarlous taking the ball. It's Dan Heron. It was different. It was special the way that they won, because I don't think a lot of people going into that season, especially now just down to Zito as part of the starters, maybe this wasn't going to work out, but they were able to fight through it. And we all know, you know, Marco Scudero having this fantastic season and filling in chemistry. So I think Kotze can see the value in that. And the one thing about this A's club that we've seen for the last 3 years has been their chemistry, or the last 4 years, because they all came up together. And you're seeing it now, right? The wedding pictures from Matt Chapman's wedding. There's Marcus Semien. There's Matt Olson. And there's Shamaniah. They're all together, right? Olson's wedding, the same thing. It's the same group of guys. That's how tight they were. That's what's going to be hard if a lot of these guys are gone, is how do you build chemistry again?
Yeah, which takes us to the other big storyline of this offseason, right? Is this roster. How's it going to look like? Who's going to be traded? You know, who's going to be a part of this club come February, come spring training, or whenever spring camp begins, right? We'll see when this lockout ends, because right now we got a transaction freeze. Not a whole lot can happen right now. But Kotze, A's can't fill out their coaching staff. But we don't know what this roster is going to be like. And it's kind of a strange waiting game right now. In limbo right now, right? Everything's in limbo right now. And it's strange because we do expect a lot of movement and a lot of activity for the A's before the season starts. But right now, it is on hold, and just don't know. But what's it like for a new manager like Kotze right now, not knowing who he's going to have at his disposal right now? He's trying to get ready. He's trying to prepare as much as he can, yet the pause button is hit, and we don't know when things are going to unpause right now.
Yeah, you know, basically what he's doing, or I imagine what he's doing, is he's laying out spring training. He doesn't know who the players are, but he's going to lay out how he wants spring training to go. And he definitely knows what minor league players are going to be there. That's been talked about, I'm sure. But you have no idea what the major league club looks like. So you can just kind of plan for how we want things to go and what we want to work on and how our day-to-day is going to be. But you don't know who's going to be there. And I think, you know, the next time the players and owners talk will probably be mid-January. I really don't see anything being done and settled until February. And then it's just going to be this 2 weeks of wheeling and dealing as teams try and set their rosters. I think it's just going to be, the Wild West for those 2 weeks before spring training starts.
It's going to be crazy. I think spring training is probably going to be a little bit shortened and abbreviated, right? Just to have the season start somewhat close to when it's supposed to start if things do get backed up. I think it's going to be okay, right? I mean, I don't know how much we've talked about this, but I don't think we need 6 weeks of spring training. We don't. So if it gets abbreviated a little bit, try to keep things a little bit on pace. I think that's probably a good thing too, but we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. We'll see what gets put into the collective bargaining agreement and maybe how that influences how the A's proceed with some of the moves they make. Phil, I tell you what, how about we take a quick break? We come back and it's Hall of Fame voting season right now.
It's Hall of Fame voting season. Favorite time of year, and Joe Stiglitz is a voter. So it's time for Joe to reveal his 2022 ballot, and Joe, we're going to look a little bit at your history too and try and guess which way you're going here.
I like that. I like the sound of that. Let's do that. So let's take a quick break here. We'll be right back, folks. Stick with us on the Green and Bold podcast.
All right. Welcome back to the Green and Bold podcast. David Feldman here alongside Hall of Fame voter Joe Stiglitz. That still must feel pretty good when we say Hall of Fame voter.
It feels pretty good. It's pretty cool, Feldy. I don't know. Like I've always said, every year you get that ballot in the mail, it's a special feeling. It's an honor. It's an honor because there aren't a lot of people that get to do this, and it's not something I take lightly or for granted. It's just very, very, very cool thing to be able to do, and it means a lot to me. And I put a lot of time pouring through those candidates and coming up with who I'm going to vote for.
Yeah, you know, the voting process has definitely changed now with the transparency in Twitter and our friend Ryan Thibodeau and his Hall of Fame ballot tracker, you know, real-time tracking of the Hall of Fame vote. This didn't exist 10 years ago, right? And so also every non-voter gets to voice their opinion on every ballot that they see and pass judgment. And let's just say people on Twitter are not always nice.
They're not. People get more heated about this than anything I've ever put on Twitter. That goes back to when I was covering the A's beat too. People get heated about the Hall of Fame voting. They are passionate about it. They have their opinions, and sometimes they get very vocal about it.
Yeah, and they, of course, are always right, and you are always wrong, because that's how it works in Twitter.
It does. It does. But you know what? We know that's the deal. We know that's the deal. And if you're going to put your vote out there for the public to be transparent, that's the whole idea, to be transparent. I guess you got to take some of the blowback that comes with it. But you're right. It has really shifted a lot. And hats off to Ryan Thibodeau, too, huh, for the resource he provides. I mean, it's really cool. I mean, it's such a great, captivating for all of us to follow as the voting is unfolding, right? Over the month and a half that ballots are eligible to be sent in. He does a great job. Him and his team do a fantastic job with that.
It is. It really does. It gives us something in December to do baseball wise, even more so with a lockout now. I mean, this is where all the focus is on the Hall of Fame voting. And as we speak and record this now, according to the tracker, David Ortiz is up just over 80%, new to the ballot this year. And then our old friends, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, their last year on the ballot, they are right around 75%, and you need 75% for induction. There is not a big return yet. I think there's still less than 40% over counting, way less than 40%, I believe.
Yeah.
So you also have Curt Schilling in his last year on the ballot. He is tracking a little under 70%. He missed out on the Hall of Fame last year by 23 votes. Right now, it's going to be real close again for him. For Joe Stiglitz, I believe this is your sixth time as a Hall of Fame voter.
Mm-hmm.
Your first time in 2017, your first ballot. These guys all made the Hall of Fame eventually, and that was Jeff Bagwell,
mm-hmm.
Vladimir Guerrero, Trevor Hoffman, Tim Raines, Yvonne Rodriguez. And then you voted also for Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling.
Yeah, and eight people that first year, I remember.
Eight people. And you have voted for Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling every year.
Yeah.
Which, that's great. That's consistency. And I remember you wrote an article explaining why you voted for Bonds and Clemens. And basically your argument was, hey, before we knew about their steroid use, they were already Hall of Fame players.
Right. Yeah. You're right. That carries a lot of weight with me. The fact that before the PED suspicions came in with Bonds and Clemens, you just take their body of work before you start thinking about how steroids may have clouded things. And I think that body of work before those suspicions set in, yeah, I think we're Cooperstown worthy. So that carries a lot of weight for both those players for me, for sure.
And then you talked about Curt Schilling and you said, yeah, and I'm going to paraphrase and put words in your mouth and say he was pretty much a douche off the field, especially with his social media comments targeting writers specifically.
Right.
And he was a bad dude. But we're not voting on whether he's a bad dude or not. We're voting on him whether he was a Hall of Fame baseball player. And you thought that his career was good enough to make the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically, especially that postseason resume was good as just about anybody in the game from a pitching standpoint when it comes to his postseason body work. Carried a lot of weight with me with Curt Schilling and kind of he's not the most popular dude. Maybe he's not that good of a dude with some of the stuff that he's done and said and suggested on social media. But again, I think there are a lot of bad dudes already in the Hall of Fame probably, and they're not coming out. And we're voting on what they did between the lines and what kind of baseball player they were. And that's why Curt Schilling has got my vote each and every year so far. And it's crazy that three of them are all in the 10th year together here. They're last on the ballot.
Last on the ballot. So just, again, looking back on your 2018 ballot, besides Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling, you had to vote for Vladimir Guerrero again and Hoffman again, and they both got in that year in 2018. You also gave Chipper Jones, Edgar Martinez, and Jim Thome your vote. Thome got in that first year in 2018. In 2019, it was Roy Halladay. It was Edgar Martinez again. Mariano Rivera, who everybody voted for. And then in 2020, it was Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling, and Jeter.
Mm-hmm.
Jeter getting in with all but one person voting for him, and we still don't know who the one is. And then last year, a year where no player was elected by the baseball writers, it was, again, just Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling. So using your history, I'm going to guess that three names you checked on your 2022 ballot was Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling.
Oh, you would be correct there. No, that's good detective work right there. And obviously, obviously, if I've been voting for them, there's no reason for me to take them off. You know, for some people, the struggle is they don't think 10 is enough. We can vote for a max of 10 players on this ballot. Used to be 15, I believe, before I got a vote. I believe it was maybe 15 at one point. Right. Shrunk it to 10 by the time I started voting. For some people, they got to leave some people off. They're tough choices for them to leave off just to get it down to 10. I guess you could say I'm a small hall voter. And you know, I don't consciously say look, I'm going to cap it at 4. I'm going to cap it at 3. I'm going to cap it at 5. My first year I did 8, and it just so happens, as years have gone on, I've voted for fewer and fewer people because I just, I have pretty high standards. Pretty high standards.
And, that's my puppy, Luca. He's got a blood curling bark. He doesn't know how to bark yet.
And I don't think he wants Bonds, Clemens, or Schilling in the Hall of Fame, maybe. That's the point he's getting across right now. You know what? He gets a say in this, too. He's got to have his say, too.
And oh who's God. Going to I swear one day the cops are going to get called. And so they learn how to bark like a real dog. Yeah, okay, buddy. Okay, sorry, buddy. Okay.
Yeah, time Luca made appearance. You know what? It's about time Luca made an appearance on the podcast, I think. It's been too long. I like it.
You know, there's this, he's got. Sorry, okay, everybody. He'll calm down. There's another dog outside the window, and it's funny. Right typical there. Small dog, as soon as there's, if there's as long as there's a wall between him and the other dog, then yeah. He can be this tough guy.
Can't expect him to be quiet when there's another dog walking by. It's almost not fair. I mean, come on. All right, buddy, we're giving Feldy just 1 second here.
All right.
He's collected Luca. He's got Luca with him.
Here, be calm down. Oh, boy. So
Luca is now the model of composure right now.
Yeah.
You have the magic.
Now he's interested in the conversation. The
magic touch. See, everybody wants to join in on Hall of Fame voting. Everybody's got something to say when it comes to Hall of Fame voting.
So with that said.
So, yeah, those three again. I don't consciously try to be a small hall voter. I don't know. I'm just really, really choosy. And really selective with who I'm going to put in there, because I think it should be extremely elite. Only the elite of the elite of the elite should get into the Hall of Fame. And so just the way I look at it. So that's why my ballot's kind of gotten smaller as years have gone by, but that could change from year to year. We'll see. But you're right. Bonds, Clemens, Schilling, all have gotten my vote. All have gotten my vote once again.
Well, and so that, first of all, it's always been a 10-person ballot. It was 15 years on the ballot. Originally, and then they closed that down to 10 years on the ballot.
That's right, for candidates. You're right, 15 years, and now they're down to 10 years eligibility. And there's been a lot of people wanting to expand the ballot to be able to vote for more than 10. And that's been a debate for a number of years. You're right, correct.
Yeah, I think I'm a small hall thinker. I'm not a voter, but the way I think is small hall, like you, the elite, the best. So I think 10, people who feel like they have to vote for 10, I don't know. I think they're just filling it out, and they're putting guys, giving votes to guys who probably don't deserve it, in my opinion. But that's the way I think. But knowing your history now, we would say that all the players that are returned to the ballot this year, you were not voting for. So that's the people who are getting a groundswell of support, especially on Twitter, are players, specifically Scott Rowland is getting a big push. And we're also seeing Andrew Jones with a big push.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on why you don't vote for them?
Andrew Jones has a pretty compelling case. There's lots of guys that have a compelling case. Andrew Jones, for me, 251 career hitter, I think. I think he had 10 gold gloves, which playing center field is pretty amazing. The home run numbers are up there. Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think. He was in the 400s when it comes to the home runs that he hits, and he's got all the gold gloves. For me, just not – a large enough body of work of dominant seasons, though. For me, the body of work was just a little bit too small as far as the dominance. And that carries a lot of weight with me, is the longevity. And what was a player's span of dominant seasons, and how long did it go for? How consistently great were they? How consistently excellent were they? You know, the last six, okay, Andrew Jones played 17 seasons. The last six of those weren't really good. You know, and that's more than one third of his career. So didn't have anything real spectacular when it came to his postseason resume. And I just can't give my vote. 434 career homers to go with all those gold gloves, 730 plus homer seasons. Hell of a career. Great career. Just not quite enough to get my vote for Cooperstown. Scott Rowland, I think you also mentioned he's getting a lot of support. I thought long and hard about him over the years. And one of the reasons I do that is third base is so underrepresented right now as a position in the Hall of Fame. But again, Scott Rowland, when you look at, the number of games he played. He missed a lot of time with injuries, you know, and that's not, I mean, you don't want to knock a guy for that. If a guy is injured, a guy's injured. But again, the durability, the longevity means something for me. We look at his numbers, 316 career homers. He's an 8-time gold glove winner at a position where defense is at a premium. I know his 8 gold gloves trail only Mike Schmidt and Brooks Robinson at third base. Again, didn't do all that much in the postseason and missed a lot of games, just missed too many games for me over the course of his career. You look at the number of games where Scott Rolen reached even just like 130 games played. It's not that many. And compared to, and I don't have his resume up in front of me right now at the moment. I'm scrolling through my notes trying to find it here, but just not enough, not a long enough body of work, and not the durability that I think is really important to get a guy in the Hall of Fame. But I understand, I kind of understand where the support's coming from, and I kind of think long and hard about Scott Rolen every year. And part of that is I think third base is pretty underrepresented right now.
Another returner to the ballot, or a couple of the lump them in the steroid guys, and that's Manny Ramirez and Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, and this is where it gets a little bit murky, and people talk to the writers aren't being, the voters aren't really being consistent when it comes to the PED guys. And I just don't think, and Feldy, I mentioned this before, it's hard to apply any uniform criteria to everybody because there are so many variables. And you know, the voting guidelines, we don't get a whole lot of guidelines from the Hall of Fame about what to consider. They talk about the character, they talk about the integrity, but when it comes to some of these PED guys, there's got to be a little degree of subjectivity to it. And I think everybody's got to make their own individual decisions on these guys. And I look at each candidate and those that have steroid suspicions tied to them. I kind of look at them individually and just really look at them as an individual case. And Manny, we're talking about one of the best right-handed hitters of all time. I know he also got popped twice for PEDs after league mandated testing began, which I think was in 2004, right around then. Got popped twice, 2009 and 2011. And for me to get suspended twice for that, and I know he chose to retire after the second suspension, which would have been 100 games, that was just a little too much for me to vote for him right now. Getting busted twice for me, that's kind of why I voted no for him. I struggle. I wrestle with Manny every year, probably more than any other player. I go back and forth on him, but right now I've kind of held a strict line because you get busted once and then you get busted again. That's just a tough one for me to swallow. It's a tough one for me to swallow.
No, it is. One more returning.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, just one more returning guy you're not voting for, and that's Gary Sheffield.
Yeah, and Sheffield, a lot of people vocal about Sheffield on Twitter too. He's got the 500 homers, but I think he got those 500 homers. 500 homers, just reaching 500 homers is just strictly that as your benchmark for Hall of Fame. That number's not what it used to be, I don't think, as far as the magic automatically in for Hall of Fame, just the era he played in. Home run numbers were so inflated. And he was not a very good defender, not a very good defender in the outfield. I kind of hold that against him too. And so that's why I don't vote for Gary Sheffield. It's just the subpar defense kind of sticks with me on Gary Sheffield. Same with Jeff Kent too. Look, and I'm a Bay Area guy. I watched Jeff Kent play a lot of games. I know how great he was, more homers than any second baseman in history. I don't think the defense was there at a position where defense is very demanding. So the defense is a big knock for me against Sheffield and against Jeff Kent.
All right.
Yeah.
So let's look at some of the new guys on the ballot. Guys, you had a choice to add to, again, Bonds, Clemens, and Schilling. You voted for the three. Let's start with the obvious one, and that was the obvious guy who's a front runner as a first-year guy is David Ortiz.
David Ortiz got a yes vote for me.
Yes.
He got a yes vote for me. 541 homers. I know I just got done saying that the 500 homer benchmark isn't what it used to be as far as that magical number that gets a guy in. But we're talking about really one of the most productive sluggers in the era that he played in. Extra base hits, I want to say 7th all-time in extra base hits, 7th or 8th all-time in extra base hits. And with Big Poppy, for me, along with all the homers and all the numbers, and he had a 20-year career, the postseason resume that he has really jumps off the page. Sort of similar to Schilling, and obviously they were teammates for a while. Ortiz's postseason resume he gets big time bonus points for me with the postseason resume that he has. And you look at the three World Series he contributed to with the Red Sox, really a central figure, maybe you could say the cornerstone player, the common link in all three of those World Series he had. Let's go back to 2004, right? The kind of that magical year where they kind of shed the curse of the Bambino, and the Red Sox fall down 3-0 right to the Yankees in the ALCS. They come back and they win that. Ortiz was a driving force behind that. He was the MVP of that ALCS. At the time, he had a record. It was 11 RBIs he had against the Yankees to help propel Boston and get them over the hump and into the World Series, which they eventually won. He had 19 RBIs overall in that postseason in 2004. At that time, that was a postseason record. Okay, jump in 2007 when they beat up on the Rockies, who were red hot coming into the World Series, and Ortiz, he slashed 370, 508, 696. That was his slash line in the postseason that year. And in 2013, he went off too. I mean, just went off 11 for 16 in the World Series alone. In that postseason, he hit 353, five homers, 13 RBIs. So just you look at what he did in the postseason, that just like Curt Schilling, I put a lot of extra value on that. And Ortiz, you look at 59, he had 59 plate appearances in the World Series. He slashed 455, 576, 795. And the only player that even comes close to that, those stats across the board, would be Barry Bonds. And he did that in only 30 plate appearances. And hats to Jay Jaffe. You know, I use his, all of the database that he has, the articles that he writes. It's a very helpful resource, too, when it comes to Hall of Fame voting, all the work that he does. But Big Poppy, for me, the postseason resume had a lot to do with it. His longevity, too. You know, he had his last 4 years. You know, he retired at age 40. His last 4 years, over 30 homers, over 100 RBIs each of those last 4 years. The guy drove in 127 runs in his last season at age 40. Yeah. So
in a year he could barely walk. He could barely walk that year, and he put up those numbers.
And look, no coincidence. I know that his numbers jumped when he went to the Red Sox, right? And he's banging doubles and extra base hits off the Green Monster. He had that to his advantage, but just the consistency and the excellent the numbers he put up for such a long time, and the postseason resume for me put it over the top of me with David Ortiz.
Yeah, it's just as a fan, I agree. I thought David Ortiz was a Hall of Famer. I thought he was a Hall of Famer when we watched him play. And we've talked about that before. You know you're watching a Hall of Famer, right? When you watch Mike Trout play, you say, okay, I'm watching a Hall of Famer. When you watch Miguel Cabrera, I'm watching a Hall of Famer. I felt that way with David Ortiz. I had no doubt, you know, I know a lot of sabermetric people and everybody else, they don't believe in clutch hitting, clutchiness. No, David Ortiz showed you what clutch hitting was. And it wasn't just the walk-offs in the 04 LCS. As you said, the numbers every postseason, he was better and better. And if you look at 03 against the A's, he hits the big double off the wall against Keith Foulke in the eighth inning. You look at 04 in the Angels series, their division series, Vladimir Guerrero hits a grand slam to tie it up for the Angels. And Ortiz hits his first postseason walk-off homer in that game. It's a walk-off series winner. Just the timeliness, the clutch, October's with David Ortiz. I mean, he's there. He was a Hall of Fame player. So I think he's going to get in as a first ballot guy. I know there is the 2003 anonymous test that was attributed to him. Remember in 03, they did a testing of players. It's supposed to be anonymous. And if they had over 5% positives, then they could implement their testing program. And it was over 10%. But there was also at least 10 false positives in that sample. Ortiz's name came out in 2009, along with Sammy Sosa. And that's the only time Sammy Sosa has ever been really officially linked to any steroid use, was also in those tests. But Ortiz, he played in the testing era. And he got tested as much as, or if not more than, any other player, and never had an issue. So I think that puts the 2003 test to rest, and you say what he did was legitimate and he's a Hall of Famer. So yeah, I agree. I think.
And there are, yeah, no, you're right. Good points you make. And it's hard to draw like concrete conclusions based on those 03 tests, because there's some mystery as to, okay, what exactly were these guys testing positive for, and what was it exactly? There's still a lot of unknowns when it comes to that. But Ortiz, The numbers are there. The postseason, the huge postseason numbers are there. And that's important because we're talking about, for the most part, purely a DH. I mean, he's got some games at first base, but we're going strictly on offensive numbers. That's what he was, you know, and it's tough for a pure DH. You know, Edgar got in a few years ago, but Edgar played in the field a little bit more than Ortiz did. And their numbers are similar. Ortiz is tops Edgar Martinez when it comes to like county numbers, but like the rate statistics, Edgar's got him a little bit. But, you know, Edgar got in as mostly a DH, and we'll see about David Ortiz, but gets my vote. And to me, he's a first ballot guy. And I don't purposely hold people off saying, you know, he's not a first ballot guy, so I'm not going to vote for him this year. If he's on the ballot the first time, I think he deserves to get in. He deserves to get in that first year. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's the way it should be. You're a Hall of Famer or you're not a Hall of Famer. It's not wait another year and then you get to go in. You're a Hall of Famer.
It doesn't mean I didn't mean to cut you off, but it doesn't mean that your opinion can't change on a player. I actually didn't vote for Edgar Martinez my first year voting, and I voted for my second year just after looking at the body of work a little bit more, and I'm like, boy, this guy was pretty incredible. I'm going to vote for him. And a lot of voters do that over the years, and that's one great reason for having a player on a ballot 10 years. It gives people time to kind of consider, because sometimes you build up more research, more intelligence about a player, and maybe your opinions eventually do change over year to year. I try not to do that. I try to be rock solid consistent for the most part. I think I am. But there you go. David Ortiz is number four. He was number four on my ballot this year.
So another new name on the ballot, Alex Rodriguez.
Is he ever not a polarizing figure, Feldy? Is he ever not a polarizing figure, right? And he is, I think, when it comes to the Hall of Fame this year. Oh, Alex Rodriguez. He got a yes vote for me.
Wow.
He's a fifth player.
I'm shocked.
I have a five-player ballot this year, and Alex Rodriguez made it for me. And I thought long and hard about this one. Alex Rodriguez, we're talking about one of the great all-around players of all time. I'm convinced of that. And I can't believe that the PEDs were a driving force behind him being one of the greatest players of all time. And like I said, I think the Hall of Fame is certain players. The Hall of Fame is built for players like Barry Bonds, like Roger Clemens, and like Alex Rodriguez. And I just, it's hard for me to keep him out. And I know, look, he's got the guy served a year-long suspension, right? For PEDs. He was mentioned as far back as 2003 in that anonymous testing. But again, can't put too much stock into 2003 and what that happens. There's a lot of unknown with that. And you know, A-Rod's never tested positive under the joint drug agreement. He hasn't. He was given a year-long suspension. But LB did a lot of digging to find that suspension. They dug long and hard and did a lot of research and just spent a lot of time on that. A lot of people criticize a lot of the methods MLB used to go after A-Rod. And some people think it was a little bit of a witch hunt, but look, he's all but admitted to it that he's taken PEDs. Like I said, I kind of treat each PED suspicion player as his own separate case. And when I look at Alex Rodriguez, and one thing I look at, you know, with his career, you look at the first 5 years of Alex Rodriguez's career. Okay. Before the PED suspicion set in, okay. Let's consider his first five full seasons with the Seattle Mariners. Okay. This is before any documented or any suspected PED use took place. This is what Alex Rodriguez did first 5 years with the Seattle Mariners. He won a batting title at age 20, hit 358. He had a 40-40 season. Overall, in those 5 years, he hit 315, 956 OPS, which is pretty fantastic. And he averaged 37 homers and 115 RBIs. Over 100 runs scored each of those 5 years. He had a pair of 200 hit seasons in those first five seasons. What I'm saying is, this is a guy who was well on his way to a legendary career before the PED stuff started being talked about, before the suspicion set in. To me, he's an all-time great, and he would have been without the PEDs too, I think. And that's why he got my vote. And after, look at this, he's suspended for the 2014 season, comes back the next year, he's 39 years old, and he hits 33 home runs. And I'm pretty sure he was probably clean at that point. You know, after 2003 and before, let's say 2010, I think when you piece it together, that's probably like a time frame where it seems he was clean and he wasn't using, at least if, all the reports. That's what reports suggest. And that's when he had some of his biggest monster seasons, won two MVPs during that time. So, again, it's hard to apply uniform concrete criteria for everybody. I take it case by case. And for A-Rod, he's not a guy I can keep out of Cooperstown. I think he should be a Hall of Famer.
So the reason I said I was shocked is because of the suspension and Manny Ramirez kind of having the same issue with his suspensions. But the way you explained it makes sense to me, and it's more in line with your thinking on Bonds and Clemens.
Yeah.
That's very consistent. I just thought maybe the suspension would hold enough weight that you would say, no, I'm not, you know, Manny, you've got two failed tests and during the testing and
yeah,
A-Rod and all his business and the biogenesis scandal and all that. But you feel, and much like with Bonds, that he did enough that he'd proven that he's a Hall of Fame player.
That's it. Yeah. But let me tell you that A-Rod, and I thought long and hard about that. I'm like, I'm voting for A-Rod and I'm not voting for Manny, but Manny did get busted twice. And I guess that's a difference for me. And A-Rod, you know, A-Rod, just a more complete player. You know, he won a couple of gold gloves too.
Sure.
I mean, terrific numbers, shortstop, third base. I mean, some people think that Jeter should have moved over and made room for A-Rod at shortstop when Jeter, you know, when the Yankees got him. And he was that good of a defender in an era where he was going against Nomar and Jeter. There were some great shortstops there that were kind of seemed like their career paths were all in the same line, you know, the same coming up at the same time or close to it. I'm kind of weighing pluses and minuses for all players, and A-Rod, the complete player he was, everything that goes with it, he got my vote, and Manny does not.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are in a no-win situation, the voters are, with you know, trying to balance the steroid allegations and who did what, when, where. I mean, it really is a no-win, especially because you don't get a lot of guidance from the Hall of Fame. You have to make your own choices, and so I don't envy you that at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess with Manny, maybe I just feel like more of a reckless disregard for the rules when he gets busted twice within a span of a couple of years. But again, I know A-Rod served a long, very lengthy suspension too, and probably wasn't the most honest guy in his public comments about his use, you know, or when he was denying it. But you know what? If we get into making judgments on athletes who aren't truthful when they got a microphone in front of them, we're never going to vote for another Hall of Famer again, as far as I'm concerned, you know. So, again, so five players this year, that's who I voted for. And tremendous honor, but a tremendously, it's a very tough job every year too. And trying to apply as consistent logic as I can to it. It's an imperfect process right now. I think every Hall of Fame voter would probably tell you that.
Well, I appreciate you explaining it the way you did. Were there any other first-year guys that – you maybe did a little more research on that you would have thought, guys like Jimmy Rollins or Ryan Howard, Jonathan Papelbon?
Yeah, I tell you what, this year, I thought overall as a first-year class of first-year guys, this year's class was stronger than, say, last year, past years. A couple of years, you're like, how did that guy even get on the ballot, you know? I believe it's a six-person committee that votes on who should go on the ballot, and a player just needs to get two of the six votes to actually make the ballot, okay? So you know, last year there were a couple guys like, how did this guy get on? And I think Shane Victorino was on the ballot last year, right? And it's like, holy cow, what's that all about? Say nothing. I mean, great career, but it just, you know, it wasn't going to get my consideration for the Hall of Fame. This year, it was a pretty strong class of first year players, I feel like, but nobody where I was really tempted to really, really consider giving a vote to. Jimmy Rollins, I gave, you know, looking at his numbers and just taking into account his career, what a great career that guy had, right? Barry, a product, phenomenal player. And if this was the Hall of really, really, really good, or even the Hall of great, Jimmy Rollins would be in for me. But he was one guy who, I look back at his numbers, I'm like, man, his career is even better than I thought. Mark Teixeira too. Mark Teixeira put up some great numbers and had a great long career. But again, just the sustained dominance for those players, their sustained excellence wasn't quite there for me. Ryan Howard had a great few years, but it was a very short-lived time of dominance for Ryan Howard. Not enough for me there. Jonathan Papelbon, not as strong a case as a Billy Wagner, and I don't vote for Billy Wagner. That's another guy who's actually getting more and more support over the years too, is Billy Wagner. And there aren't a lot of closers in right now. And I'm still, you know, I debate each year, you know, the role of the closer has changed. And, you know, how should that affect my voting? I'm still kind of thinking, I'm kind of thinking through that each year too. But Billy Wagner, the just the innings and the overall, the longevity, I don't think was there for as dominant as Billy Wagner was. But you mentioned Jonathan Papelbon. Joe Nathan's getting a lot of love too.
Yeah.
But if I'm not voting for Wagner, I'm probably not voting for Nathan and definitely not Papelbon.
Yeah. I think you're right. It is a very strong first year class with a lot of players with great careers, just not Hall of Fame careers. I mean, Prince Fielder might have been a Hall of Famer if he could have stayed healthy and played longer.
Yeah.
And kept hitting home runs at the rate that he did. But unfortunately, the injury got him and shortened his career. And, you know, Justin Morneau, a former MVP, again, tremendous career, but.
MVP, he had a batting title too, but again, just not. You know, just not, we're talking the Hall of Fame here, not long enough, not dominance, excellence for a long enough period of time.
And I saw our friend from the San Francisco Chronicle, Bruce Jenkins, is going to vote for Tim Lincecum. Bruce likes to throw votes around, which is fine. It's his right as a voter. Do what you want.
Yeah.
And again, it's a honorary vote for Tim Lincecum, right? Two back-to-back Cy Young Award winners, and there was nobody quite like him for the first part of his career. And fortunately, he couldn't keep it going.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was nobody better for those few years. He was just an electric player, an electric presence, right, in that ballpark and for the Giants fan base in the Bay Area. And you know, Bruce has been in the Bay Area, right? He's a Bay Area journalist. He saw a lot of Tim Lincecum games. Just for me, as great as he was for that very short time, it was a very small window. Very small window of time before Tim Lincecum's star kind of fell a little bit. So I couldn't give my vote, but it's amazing how great he was for that short period of time, but I need to see it for a longer period of time. And some of it is who you see on a regular basis. You know, sure. I don't vote for Omar Vizquel. Maybe if I was a Giants beat writer for as long as I covered the A's, maybe just the eyeball test. Now all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm swayed to vote for Omar Vizquel having watched him for so long, but well, the offensive numbers just weren't, you know, compared to a guy like Ozzie Smith, and they just don't stack up. And Ozzie wasn't a great hitter by any means, but Omar Vizquel, just the numbers, some saber metrics don't do it for me.
And talk about off the field matters really clouding his Hall of Fame case.
Yeah,
Tracker, he's like down 21 votes already, and that's all due to the off the field stuff, not anything that he did on the field.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about that. Yeah, that stuff's come out just in the past couple of years too. Some troubling stuff too. So, but another guy that hasn't gotten my vote.
Yeah, it's always fun this time of year, and again, just the conversations that you can have. And once again, why don't you just give us your 5-person ballot?
Yeah, my 5-person ballot is Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and Curt Schilling and David Ortiz. And Alex Rodriguez, five votes for me for this year for the class of 2022, I guess we would call it.
Class of 2022. Yeah, I was just looking ahead to the class of 2023 because that's what we do, right?
Yeah.
Look ahead to who do you get to vote for next year? And it's not a great first year class. Carlos Beltran might be the biggest name. Probably not a Hall of Famer. Jake Peavy, John Lackey.
And PV was on this year's ballot.
Yes, that's right. PV
was on this year's ballot. Yeah, again, another great, really, really good career and Cy Young winner. You know, just not enough for me, not enough to sway me there.
I think an interesting guy as far as relievers go is going to be Francisco Rodriguez.
Uh-huh. K-Rod.
K-Rod, right? 437 saves, the single season record, long career. Burst onto the scene with the 2002 Angels winning the World Series. A's fans got their fill of them. They also got the dropped ball incident with Kendall racing home, thanks to K-Rod. But he'll be an interesting choice to see how people vote with him on the same ballot with Joe Nathan and Jonathan Papelbon and Billy Wagner, where Francisco Rodriguez is going to fall.
You know, maybe because he came up so early and he was such a stud so early, it's crazy to think of him as being retired in a Hall of Fame ballot. Because I think of Francisco Rodriguez, I think of a young pitcher. You know what I mean by that? I think it's somebody who was young, so it's funny. But it's funny how you think of different things. But it's like, hey, let me just mention one last thing about, I vote for Roger Clemens, but when you look at it through green and gold lens, thinking back to the postseason and just the postseason struggles he had against the A's is really something. So I want to say seven starts, postseason starts against the A's, did not just single victory, not a single win on the mound for Roger Clemens against the A's. And that's just not with the with the Red Sox, too. When he got to the Yankees, too, it didn't get much better for him.
It wasn't all Stewart, right? This was Roger Clemens taking the mound in 2000 in game one, losing four with a chance to clinch the series, right? And Omedel Sines is a three-run homer against him in the first inning. Omedel Sines, a right-handed hitter, got the start. It's a three-run homer in the first inning against Roger Clemens. Yeah, the A's owned Roger Clemens. Yeah. In any big game, they knew they were going to beat him. It didn't matter if Stu was on the other side.
Right.
When Stu was on the other side, there was never any question. But even later, if Gil Heredia was on the other side, Roger Clemens still was going to lose.
Yeah. Yeah. I just because I wanted to see how much him and Stu didn't match up as much as I thought I remembered in the postseason. So I was looking through some old box scores. It's just so funny to see the names that jump out at you that you haven't thought of for a while. Bruce Hurst. Bruce Hurst was one of the top Red Sox top pitchers one of those years. Started a game one, and I think a game four, I want to say, against the A's. Yeah. The middle of the lineup, Mike Greenwell, you know, anchoring, I think, in the cleanup spot, Mike Greenwell. And Jim Rice was still going. He was still on those teams.
Dwight Evans was on the team in 88.
Dwight Evans, Jim Rice, a little bit lower in the lineup at that time. But, yeah, just fun going back and reading all those names, man.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, Stu and Stewart. Or Stu and Clemens in the 90 playoffs matched up in game one, which was a 0-0 game. And actually the Red Sox took a 1-0 lead when Clemens was still on the mound, but Clemens was coming back from an injury and only went the first six innings. And then when the Red Sox went to the bullpen, especially Larry Anderson, the A's exploded, ended up winning that game 9-1. And then in game four, that was the Roger Clemens getting thrown out of the game, wearing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on his shoelaces, the eye black.
The eye black is what I remember, yeah.
Yelling at Terry Cooney, the home plate umpire, scaring the heck out of Mike Gallego because Gallego thought he was yelling at him. And you could tell even then, I mean, Clemens had some weird stuff going on in his head. And he was a competitor, but he was also a little nuts. Just ask Mike Piazza about that, the broken bat in the World Series.
Right, and Subway Clemens Series. Picks
it
up,
throws it at him, and later claims, I thought it was the ball. Yeah, come on now, man. So Clemens was a little nuts, and I'm pretty sure he got himself thrown out of that game because he knew he wasn't beating Stu.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Love go down memory lane. I tell you what, man, I hope at some point this offseason, I think we still have a long wait ahead of us, but I can't wait for the time where we're talking about A's roster and who's on it and what things are looking like looking ahead to spring training. Philly, look, we're less than 2 months away from what should be the start of spring training at this point, if things go off as planned, man, the off season flies by.
Yeah.
Off season flies by, but there's going to be a lot of activity. I think the A's are going to be included in that. A lot of transactions, going to be a frenzy of activity between the time the lockout ends and between the time pitchers and catchers report, and maybe the activity that moves are going to go on even after spring training begins.
Yeah. I think it's going to be, like I said, the Wild West. I think all through whatever shape and form spring training takes, I think we're going to see moves during that time period. March is going to be crazy. How the A's shake up, what their payroll, what their roster looks like, what Howard Terminal looks like. I mean,
We didn't even touch on that. Environmental report was released by the city of Oakland. Positive step, but still so many hoops to jump through. There's a lot of opposition to this project. There's a lot of people that don't want to see it happen, but the story that never ends, we always say the never-ending story. We'll see if maybe we've inched closer to some kind of conclusion to that. Hopefully it's a good one that keeps the A's in the East Bay.
Yeah, I mean, every step they take is further than they've ever been before on any sort of ballpark.
Yeah.
So even if you're on parallel paths, the path in Oakland so far is much further along than whatever is going on in Vegas.
A lot more tangible stuff has gotten done here. No doubt about that.
Exactly. So I think that that's all a positive. It's just step by step and what comes next. But so all this is going to play into what the A's decide to do going into this year. Again, they can keep Olson. They can keep Chapman. They can keep Manaea. These are all under control. And they can come back with this team. And you know, I think that would be great if they did, because I think you're going to have a competitive season if they do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go the other way and they say, hey, we need to restock the farm system, and you know what, we're going to move these guys now while we can and get something back for them. You just hope they make the right moves in the restocking. They proved that after 2014, it was painful for the 2015 and 2016 seasons. It was painful, but it paid off with three straight postseason appearances plus a competitive year last year. So keep that in mind. The decision makers have a pretty good track record with this.
Yeah. Good stuff, Hilda. Enjoyed that whole chat talking about Mark Kotze, talking Hall of Fame stuff and everything. And tip of the cap to Luca for kind of dialing things down a notch a little bit, letting us get through the rest of that episode. I'm impressed.
Yeah, he's the blood-curling bark. I don't know what that's all about.
You're the Luca whisperer. That's what you are.
I just let him chew in my hand for 15 minutes. It's fine.
Yeah. Good stuff here. Like we always say, folks, you know the drill by now. You can find us anywhere you find your podcast. That's where you can find the Green and Bold podcast. And I know lately, thanks for sticking with us. I know lately we've been filming an episode about as often as U2 drops an album, it seems like. It hasn't happened very often. We're going to try to get a few more episodes in here before the start of spring training, whenever the start of spring training might be. But we'll be on top of it. Whenever something big happens with the A's, we'll be sounding off on it. And we appreciate everybody listening. And Feldy, happy holidays to you, and good talking to you, huh?
Yeah, happy New Year to you, Joe, and happy New Year to all the A's fans out there looking for a bright and safe 2022.
Happy holidays, everybody. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time on the next episode of the Green and Bold podcast.